Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today. Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week from The Critic magazine. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's political editor, Graeme Stewart, about Winston Churchill's role in shaping British and the Allies' military strategy in the Second World War.
Professor Jeremy Black, when in May 1940 Winston Churchill becomes Prime Minister, what is the structure between the War Cabinet, the Imperial General Staff, the different departments of the military that he inherits?
Well, in effect, the War Cabinet is directing war policy, and the job of the Imperial General Staff is to implement it. As ever, the relationship between policy and strategy is an overlap. I've tried to demonstrate that in my books on strategy, that the idea of differentiating between them is not terribly helpful because policy is obviously illuminated by strategic opportunities and assessments of capability, while they themselves are in part set by the taskings of what you might call policy. But the key thing when Churchill came to power is that Britain was in a rapidly deteriorating situation, and one that was certainly far worse than had confronted her in World War One, and it was one that pushed, as it were, the pressure of the immediacy right to the fore. And from the word go, one of the issues, if you like, when you're considering Churchill as a wartime strategist, is the juxtaposition of very immediate issues and problems, let's say the disposal of military units, their deployment, and the more long-term questions of prioritisation. And in turn, the context is shifting. I mean, obviously, in any war, the context is in part a matter of one's response to an attempt to shape one's opponent's initiatives. But in the case specifically of Britain, the situation changes radically in the first 18 months because France's capitulation in June 1940 means that the British Empire is essentially fighting alone, and that situation continues until the Soviet Union comes into the war. Well, I mean, obviously, there had earlier been the German attacks on Yugoslavia and Greece in 1941, but the Soviet Union is a different quantity, and that then in turn changes when the United States comes into the war. So what one has got is an inherently, if you like to use the term, unstable context. I mean, obviously, Britain wanted an unstable context because it wanted allies against its opponents. But that unstable context makes all the relationships harder because if you're thinking about the relationship between the War Cabinet, shall we say, and the Chiefs of Staff, that becomes more complex when you have to think of coalition operations and coalition allocations of responsibility and tasking.
Is it the case that there were really any forward planning for a situation where the British Empire would find itself on its own in 1940, or was everything predicated on the assumption of the alliance with France holding?
Well, the alliance with France, it was assumed, would hold. I mean, to give you an example, there's a rather good Oxford D. Phil, now it's over 20 years old, on amphibious doctrine and the development of amphibious doctrine in the interwar years. And obviously, amphibious doctrine, in other words, large-scale landing operations against defended coasts had been a major problem with the Dardanelles. And in World War II, the British are frequently involved in these, including the largest amphibious operation in world history, D-Day, the invasion of Normandy. But the point the author makes is amphibious doctrine was not really very well developed into the interwar years because there was no sense that it would be needed. I mean, the assumption was that in the event of a war with Germany, that the British would be reinforcing their positions in France and their ally through ports that were held by the French, particularly Cherbourg, Havre, and that one wouldn't need to be attacking beaches. And that was a reasonable assumption. And interestingly enough, if you look, as I pointed out in one of my books, actually I did a book on combined operations, if you look at the state that developed most amphibious capability in the late 30s, it's Japan. And Japan develops it in large part in order to operate in southern China, but then uses that capability very successfully in its operations from December 41 through to the summer of 42. And, you know, the British have to sort of come along from a rather different position.
Well, I'm going to come to the war with Japan shortly, but I wonder if we can, for the moment, focus on what was the immediate drama when Churchill became Prime Minister, and that is the pending collapse of France. Is it really the case, as often suggested, that Churchill had to be restrained from throwing in more troops after Dunkirk, and would have squandered a lot of Britain's fighter command trying to prop up the French when it was a hopeless cause? Or actually was did he realise that no more than token gestures could be made?
Well, let's start with the point about the concept of what I call forward defence. If you assume that the situation in end of May, early to mid-June 1940 is collapsing, then you could say, let's cut our losses absolutely at once and bail out. And indeed, as you may know, in 1918, at the time of the German spring offensives on the Western Front, when the Germans knocked a hole through the West, you know, through the Allied forces, the British had contingency plans to demolish every single harbour on France's Channel coast as part of a, you know, we will withdraw and it will be very difficult then for the Germans to mount an invasion. To a certain extent, it was as advantageous as anything for the British to keep the French in the war. If you think about it, at that stage, the Soviet Union is an ally of Germany. Italy is an ally of Germany, about to come into the war in June the 10th, I think it is. Japan is an ally of Germany, and the Americans are doing absolutely nothing. So, given that circumstance, if the British wish to fight on with any chance of success, by success one's meaning here not just, as it were, facing off any attempt to invade them, but also any chance of success at inflicting more damage on Germany, then the alliance of France, which has the second largest empire in the world, which has a very large and modern fleet, as well as obviously considerable army, the alliance of France is significant. And it's also worth bearing in mind that in the very specifics of late May, early June, the French are going on fighting. Now, we all tend to focus on the idea that the German sickle advance through the Ardennes to the Channel means the end of France. It's actually a strategic disaster for the Allies. There's no two ways about it. But the French go on fighting. I think I'm right in saying more German troops are killed in June 1940 than in May 1940 by the French. And the French put up a significant resistance on the Somme and the Marne before they're overcome. Now, it is in Britain's advantage, leave aside the question of any sort of wider context of whatever you might think of in terms of relations between allies, morality, etc., etc. It is in Britain's advantage at that moment to keep the French fighting and killing Germans. And every single day which the Germans are delayed in their operations by the need to fight in France is a delay towards going to the end of the summer in 1940, and therefore making it less likely that an invasion would be mounted on Britain that summer. When, of course, the days are longer, it's easier to operate. Germany is going to be more effective against British warships trying to oppose the German shipping, etc., etc. So I don't see these as either ors. I see that as a very, I'm not saying that you personally are being unsophisticated, but I see that as a very unsophisticated approach. I would say that there is a question of how best to implement the nature of forward defence and where to do it. And that remains an issue, I would argue, in terms of Britain's relationship with France thereafter, whether you're considering the action against the French Navy at Mersel Kabir and elsewhere, whether you're considering eventual British intervention in Syria, Lebanon and Madagascar, as well as in other French colonies, whether you're considering the support for the Free French, etc., etc. There is not an automatic switch off after which you're saying, now, chaps, all we need to think about is how best to defend Britain. Let's get everybody back at home and we'll do that. It's not as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Italy joins the war as well. So there's a war in the Mediterranean. How central would you say Churchill was to that strategy of war with Italy in the Mediterranean and North Africa, or to what extent was he leaving it to the generals and the admirals?
Well, I mean, obviously, Italy declares war, so Britain wants war. Mm. The Churchill, in my view, has a very strong geographical sense of international relations and strategy. We know about his very strong interest in mapping. We know about his personal experience of travels in the world. We know about the legacy of World War One. We know about his interest and commitment to understanding naval geopolitics, but also his interest in air power. So all of those contribute to Churchill's engagement with the wider strategic implications of Italy's entry into the war, which, in putting pressure on the British in the Mediterranean and in East Africa, and in possibly linking up with the pressures the British geopolitically are going to face once France has Vichy authorities in North Africa and in Syria, Lebanon, and also once both Iraq and Iran move in a neutralist direction. All of that is something that I think Churchill is very well placed to understand. And, at the present moment, there is this critique of Churchill because of his interest and engagement with empire. Well, actually, empire was the resource, the sphere necessary to engage against the Germans, the Italians, and subsequently the Japanese. And had Britain alone been fighting, had for some reason there been no empire, then, I mean, quite frankly, the Germans would have won. That's it. And those people who decry the British Empire, which at the present moment seems to be fashionable, need to think seriously about the fact that, on the whole, it was a choice, as it had been a choice throughout world history, between empires, not empire or no empire. And if their choice is that they seriously think that the German Empire was a better empire than the British one, then I think that they are not just extraordinarily ignorant, but also I think their moral sense is very questionable. I mean, can I just say on Churchill and mapping, I mean, as you may know, he had a, in the war room, he had a chap called Richard Pym, who was a naval captain, who saw Churchill on an almost daily basis and whose job it was to maintain the maps there. And Churchill himself, when he travelled, he took along temporary map rooms. He took them, for example, at Yalta in 45. He took it to Cairo in 43. He had very detailed maps. They covered every theatre of war, and they were kept up to date with the latest intelligence reports on the location of units. And I think it's fair to say that both Churchill and Roosevelt, I mean, Roosevelt himself, had also, from his World War One background the American Navy, he was very interested in mapping. He frequently referred understanding air routes, distances on air routes, which obviously are different on globes than if you're looking on a flat map. And both of these men had that geospatial awareness, which is really very necessary for strategic insight. And I think it's fair to say that you do not get that comparable quality, if you'll think, of insight or understanding or then implementation, if you're thinking of Hitler or for that matter Mussolini.
Mm-hmm. Well, Churchill has to do something even broader than Hitler, in that Britain is fighting on in more theatres than Germany is. It's defending itself, the Atlantic, and the sea routes to supply it. So there's the Battle of the Atlantic going on. There is, as we mentioned, the war in the Mediterranean and North Africa. But also there is ultimately the defence of Asia, and that becomes the third priority, leading to the fall of Malaya and Singapore. On that, Churchill often gets blamed very heavily for failing to put sufficient resources in the defence of Southeast Asia. Do you think the criticisms have any validity? Could things have been done better, or is it just simply a matter of that was the third priority and resources were stretched?
Well, the British had not planned for a simultaneity of conflict with Germany, Italy and Japan. And I think it would have been, that would have been, as it were, a three-power standard, as to use the language of the time. I don't quite see how anybody could have been expected to produce the resources for that. What they planned for is sequential warfare, and they'd assumed that they would have a major ally, and obviously the major ally they'd assumed they'd have was France, and that had gone wrong. And it gets worse, as you know, as you've just said, when Japan comes into the war. It's very, very hard to work out in hindsight the extent to which how best you should integrate these very different wars. Clearly, resources are not totally fungible. In other words, if you have a division engaged in fighting in Libya, that division cannot be, people might be able to think they can move it around like a piece in a risk board. No, actually, war isn't like that. You cannot simply move that and repurpose that to engage adequately in war against Japan. So there's that issue. And then there's the question of prioritization, which, of course, it's worth bearing in mind, was a question affecting all powers. The Japanese, how do you prioritize between confrontation with the Soviet Union, conflict in China, and conflict with Western powers, and if you're going to do the last, where and to what ends, and so on and so forth. So in part, you're in an unstable position because you're having to respond as well as trying to shape others who themselves are not actually have not actually got a obvious policy. The notion of an obvious policy is part of the rhetoric of strategy, which generally has very little to do with the practicalities of strategic assessment. One of the great problems is all too many people cannot get their head around that intellectual difference. So if you're asking the specific question in terms of Southeast Asia, what are you precisely suggesting? Are you precisely suggesting that, I'm not saying you personally, but are people precisely suggesting that given the possibility that Japan might attack, that the British should have actually denuded the Middle East of forces in order to have them available against the chance that they attacked? Well, clearly not. So if you're then going to say, what about the exact forces that were available? Were they well used? Well, I think it's generally agreed they weren't particularly well used. The Navy very foolishly, Admiral Phillips very foolishly lost the Prince of Wales and the Repulse. The air force in Malaya was not well operate well, and the army didn't execute itself adequately. To have produced even more troops into that debacle, I'm not sure would have Britain would have been brilliant. And as far as Britain itself was concerned, if you were going to argue that the major flaw was in insufficient warships, you know, let's say you were going to say we should have had more warships in the Far East and fewer in the Atlantic or the Mediterranean, then that deal has to address the question that in the Atlantic these warships are required in part in order to ensure superiority over German surface shipping. I mean, the Bismarck has been sunk, but there's still the Scharnhorst and the Neisenauer, and the British have to protect their convoy routes, otherwise they're in dead trouble. And I think it has to be said that if you're thinking about the sinking of capital ships off Malaya, if you're thinking about the Battle of the Java Sea, if you're thinking about the sinking of British warships, including an aircraft carrier, off Sri Lanka in early April 1942, all of those suggest that more warships sent to the area would just simply have been more warships that were sunk at that stage. So I'm not entirely convinced by the argument. I mean, clearly, it's part of the rhetoric of Australian polemic, and also it reflected the Australian anxiety that they were going to be invaded, which would have been a real stretch for Japanese capability and was certainly not within the original plans of the Army, although the Navy came to become more interested in that idea. But the, you know, you've got to be very careful at taking a particular area and saying that because of anxieties about that area, therefore the whole strategic prioritisation should be different. I mean, the British government, like the American government, incidentally, took the view that Germany was a more serious threat and more capable, because of its industrial capability, etc., than Japan. And given that that was the case, and clearly the naval battle that was the most significant naval battle was the Battle of the Atlantic.
And I wonder if you could just put in perspective Churchill's contribution to strategy. He's not just Prime Minister, he's also Minister for Defence. What kind of additional authority does that give him with the heads of the Free Armed Forces?
Easy. I mean, I came across this quote, I mean, it comes from something I wrote some time ago on Churchill as a strategist. This is Dill, Field Marshal Sir John Dill, writing to Churchill on the 15th of May 1941. "I'm sure that you, better than anyone else, must realise how difficult it is for a soldier to advise against a bold defensive plan. One lays oneself open to charges of defeatism, of inertia, or even of cold feet. Human nature being what it is, there is a natural tendency to acquiesce in an offensive plan of doubtful merit rather than to face such charges. It takes a lot of moral courage not to be afraid of being thought afraid. Be that as it may, the responsible military advisers, both in this country and in France, underrated the Germans. My only concern in this particular problem, and Dill is opposing Churchill on the argument of advancing against the Italians in North Africa, my only concern in this particular problem is that we should not repeat our previous mistake of underwriting the enemy." I mean, in essence, if you're looking at a tension, I think it's fair to say that that Churchill tended to be more for getting for launching attacks, launching offensives, moving forward. The chiefs of staff tend to be more wary of that, more prone to argue a lack of necessary resources. So, for example, again, in March 1944, Churchill had urged the chiefs of staff to press for the restoration of British power in Malaya and Singapore before British forces were switched to join the Americans in the Pacific. And the chiefs of staff reply, "This assumes flexibility which would not, we fear, prove practical." And then they go on to explain that. And, you know, there are tensions there. It's easy if you're looking at the Alan Brooke to find you know, comments. I mean, on the 6th of July 1944, Churchill, Alan Brooks says of Churchill, his whole outlook on strategy was warped. So, you know, you can easily find comments like that. It ought to be said, if you look at just about anybody writing about anybody in wartime, people tend to say that sort of thing. You very rarely find, I can tell you this, having written quite a lot on military history, you very rarely find commanders saying, I have absolutely enough material and I have the full support of the government behind me and I am confident in the situation. I mean, it just doesn't happen. I mean, if you think, for example, the way Wellington endlessly campaigned about the British government during the Peninsula War, obsessing about how more resources should be devoted to his army rather than to other areas of potential or actual British commitment, and endlessly berating the government, whilst the government themselves is desperately trying to find resources, etc., etc., and Wellington is totally unsympathetic. So I think one has to be very careful. One of the problems one sees this in many of the ignorant remarks made about Churchill and Empire is that people simply don't contextualise things. They take a quotation. Sometimes they've understood it, sometimes they haven't, but that's another level of ignorance. They take a quotation and seek from that to build up a big portrayal. I mean, there are several things to say. As I argued when we were talking last time, the British manage in World War II to hold together a government that, you know, the coalition government from 1940 onwards, that is more effective in war management than the situation in World War I. I think that's important. Secondly, I think if you can think back to World War I, and not enough comparison that when people berate Churchill, they're not done enough of thinking about what had happened to the previous World War. In the previous World War, on the whole, the generals had been given their head, and they'd often argued against the politicians having a role, and on the whole, the generals had not always got it right. Let's just put it like that. We can discuss that quite, you know, we can take that further and, you know, we can talk about the tensions between Lloyd George and the generals in 1917, 1918. We can talk about manpower issues, all the rest of it. It is not as though Churchill himself is the only person that falls out with the military. And to a considerable extent, he is having to do a job of trying to maintain domestic cohesion and support. He is trying to maintain a coalition framework with very different exigencies as far as the Soviet Union and the United States are concerned, let alone other powers like Canada or Australia and so on. And given that that is the case, I think you have to understand why at times he presses the generals further than their comfort zone. And, you know, war very rarely, you know, it's interesting, you know, I quoted that thing from the Chiefs of Staff there. Well, you know, they sound very plausible, don't they? But war very rarely corresponds to the planning cycles and requirements of senior military figures. You know, that, you know, you often do need to say to them, well, we've got to try and get a move on. And it's worth bearing in mind that if you read some of the correspondence between and about generals, they make comments often fairly similar to Churchill's. I quote in one of my books, for example, bitter criticism from within the military of Alexander in 1944 in Italy for failing to actually engage the Germans south of the Apennines, for failing, in other words, to destroy their army before they can create a new front line. That's coming from within the military. It's not just Churchill who's saying this. It's worth bearing in mind that the debate between the narrow front and broad front in France in 44, or the question about whether one should go for a forward advance into Tripolitania in 41 in Western Libya, whether one should move troops to Greece, etc. Those are not just political. There's not just church and political dimension. There's also differences of opinion within the military. and one needs to understand that.
Well, you talk about Churchill's role with the Chiefs of Staff, trying to gee them up and make them more aggressive. How would you say he was at balancing the three different services, the Air Force, the Admiralty, and the Army, with their different preoccupations?
Right. Good question. Can I just say, I'm not trying to absolve Churchill of all faults. I mean, I think over the Dodecanese campaign in the Aegean, that was a disaster. So, you know, he had his mistakes, but I'm just trying to put it in context. As far as the relationship between the individual services are concerned, I mean, Churchill complained in the end about Harris being unwilling to provide very long-range aircraft for the anti-submarine campaign in the Atlantic because he wanted to focus all of them on bombing Germany. And Churchill was correct, but in a way, possibly, he should have actually sort of lent on Harris earlier. I mean, it's this ironic thing, isn't this? If you lean on people, people complain about you being a bully. If you don't lean on people, people complain that you don't lean on people. So I think that, you know, on the bombing campaign, Churchill understood the logic of trying to harm German industry, of trying to enforce the Luftwaffe primarily into home defence as opposed to fighting over the front lines, and also the fact that Britain already had the capability in that area, the industrial base in that area, and the experience. So I think that it can fairly be said that Churchill supported the bombing war, and he was correct to do so. On the Navy, I mean, Churchill was a navalist. I mean, that was very important to his understanding of geopolitics. And he also, in a way, supported retaining most of the Navy in European waters or the Atlantic until after France had been invaded and then moving it east, which is what happened. There were obviously debates, I referred to them, as to what should happen when they went east. Should they first join primarily with the Americans or should they mount a separate campaign in Southeast Asia? That doesn't make him more or less navalist. I mean, these were reasonable questions to ask. As far as the army is concerned, I mean, you know, he faced difficulties, I think it's fair to say, in North Africa. He was a man who wanted things done. I think it's fair to say that the generals themselves were not exactly delighted with each other. And, you know, he got contrary advice. But on the whole, I think he, you know, provided the right amount of support to people, including some very difficult people.
Well, his relations with the Chiefs of Staff is one thing. His relations with allies is another. Is there real evidence that Churchill was able to influence either Stalin or Roosevelt to change either Soviet or American military strategic policy in any clear way?
Well, I certainly don't think that's the case with Stalin. I mean, in the case of the United States, the position in 1942 and in 1943 is that more British combat forces were involved than against Germany and Italy than Americans. So therefore, perforce, the British had a significant role. And Churchill's argument for the value of invading Sicily and then the value of invading mainland Italy in the end prevailed, as did the argument that there shouldn't be a mounting of the Second Front in 1942 or 1943. But I think it's fair to say on the latter point, the Second Front, that would have been foolish anyway. So in other words, it was easy for Roosevelt to say he wanted a Second Front, and then, you know, in a way it's easy to blame Churchill for not getting it. But I think the reality was that the until the War of the Atlantic had been won, guaranteeing the ability to move large And until the air war had been taken to Germany and much of the Luftwaffe tied up in home defence, that it would have been foolish to invade in France. And I think Churchill was correct in that. And I think, it was one of the major contributions he made to Allied strategy. This is the one in which, in a way, you tend to underrate well-prepared operations. I mean, let me give you an example. You get far more people talking about the disastrous, and it was disastrous, failure at Arnhem, than you get people talking about the great success in crossing the Rhine in 45. This is exactly typical, isn't it? So, in a way, what was really important about the planning and the resources and the timing and the strategy was the successful invasion of Normandy and, tragic for those people who lost their lives, but at a modest cost in terms of the number of people that died on June the 6th, far lower than had been anticipated.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that if Churchill had not been Minister for Defence and had a much more relaxed attitude of letting the chiefs of staff really run the war, the outcome would have been particularly different from Britain? I know that's a difficult counterfactual question, but do you sense that he was pushing the armed forces in directions that their professional heads would not have taken them?
Well, I don't myself get much of a sense that the armed forces understood the political dimensions of geopolitics and strategy, which were, of course, extraordinarily complex. I mean, in a way, Churchill knew from the word go that and Stalin knew it, but Roosevelt didn't. He knew from the word go that the Second World War was in part a stage in the long-standing struggle over the position of the Soviet Union. And I think it's fair to say, I mean, the chiefs of staff have a committee by 44 that's planning for the possibility of war with the Soviet Union. But I think it's fair to say that the chiefs of staff don't really understand adequately the relationship between their emphasis on prudence and the possible deleterious consequences in the long term of being prudent. And it's quite interesting. I mean, I mentioned that Churchill was rash, which he was, over the Dodecanese. I think he's sending troops into Greece in late 44 to support the government against communist insurrection. And British troops were fighting communists on the streets of Athens by late 44. I think that was very prescient. I think it showed an awareness. Now, you could easily well have been a chief of staff and said, well, look, this is a much lower priority. We need to focus absolutely everything on fighting the Germans. And then, you could have found yet another Eastern European country that had been toppled by the communists, and this one much more serious because it was on the Mediterranean.
It's a final question, and it relates to Churchill's relations with Alan Brooke, the chief of the Imperial General Staff. The fuller publication of Alan Brooke's diaries shows that it was at times a very testy relationship. How would you evaluate it, though? Was that testiness actually important and useful? And who got the better out of it, Alan Brooke or Churchill, ultimately, in terms of framing more clearly the correct decisions to take?
Well, let's just take the last point first. They both did. I mean, in a way, people, you often, through disagreement, rows, and, I mean, the term is wrong here, and conflict, dissension, you often find a understanding of what's really driving the other point of view. The notion that you should reach decision-making in some sort of bland fashion of agreement, that's just ridiculous. And I think it's fair to say that you would want somebody like Alan Brooke to be standing up for himself. I mean, after all, if you think about the absolute car crash, very fortunate it was, absolute car crash of German strategy. I mean, total incompetence, the German war machine. Part of it was because total incompetence were running the, apart from Hitler himself, it was totally incompetent, but total incompetence were running the senior German military. So what you actually want is an ability to have rows and from those rows to think through where we're at. Now, I remember reading the extended Alan Brooke diary, and I remember, for example, he talks in there about Cripps coming back from Moscow and Cripps saying, you know, the Soviets are talking to the Germans. And Alan Brooke actually has a realization that this is not just about, you know, do we move Division A to place B, that this is really complex, these geopolitics and strategic issues. And you do need somebody like Churchill, who had, you know, the view, what French would call it, the longue durée, the long-term perspective, to understand these factors. And I think you've got both of them playing a significant role. I have to say, I think you see Churchill's skill again after the war. He grasps far more successfully than Labour, the Labour government, the threat caused by the Soviets taking over Eastern Europe. He grasps far more successfully than Labour, who after all sold aircraft engines, you know, to the Soviets, the military challenge posed by the Soviets. And also in the early 50s, he grasps far more quickly than most people the danger of the possibility that rollback ideas, to use the American term, would lead to the Third World War, and how, while disliking communism, it was necessary to try and find an old-fashioned, if you like, pre-1914, think of the Anglo-Russian agreement of 1907, a kind of entente in which you accept that there are different divisions of control, because otherwise you might well end human life in the Northern Hemisphere, to, you know, to paraphrase Eisenhower in 1955. So Churchill, I mean, you know, there is a crude juxtaposition: Churchill, bad as a peacetime politician, good as a wartime one. This is actually absurd. Churchill understood the key geopolitical and military challenges that continued after World War II. He actually was far more informed and observant. And sadly, one of the, you know, we've discussed this in previous programs, I've discussed it with Anthony Seldon in one of the programs I did with him, there is an overrating of Attlee, and one of the aspects of the overrating of Attlee is to fail to give sufficient attention to the way in which he was, as it were, following in his response to the Soviets, rather than actually understanding truly what was going on.
Well, that would be a very interesting podcast subject for another day. We must leave it there. Professor Jeremy Black, author of Rethinking World War II, thank you very much for discussing Churchill as a warlord of the Second World War.
Well, that's a great pleasure. If I could put in a plug for one of my other books, A History of the Second World War in 100 Maps, has a section on strategy, and it uses contemporary maps, and I think it's very important to look at contemporary maps because it gives one a sense of the cartographic facilities that contemporaries had. All too often, I mean, as you know, many people today haven't got the faintest idea of geography or where things are, but all too often when people look at past, they do so in terms of modern perceptions of spatiality, but you need to really consider the contemporary ones. And whenever somebody says to you, I mean, you know, you'll get endlessly people will say they should have done this, they should have done the other, this sort of thing. On World War II, if you really want to just find out whether they've thought about it, which most of them haven't, ask them how many days it would take a warship on average speed to get from, say, London to Cape Town in 1942. Or ask them how many tanks, after 5 days operating, what percentage of tanks in a tank unit would still generally be operational, and how that would vary by terrain and weather. And you start to understand, you have to appreciate the multiple contexts within which people had to choose, and the difficulties and problems of the use of military force, and to stop treating strategy, as if it's some, as I said, some aspect of the game of risk.
Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.